It's Wednesday, November 20th. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Overcast, wet, clammy. But inside that impeachment hearing, whoa, it's getting hot. And what I put down on my Facebook page, everyone, both The Attitude's Facebook page and my personal Facebook page, I think Sondland just threw everyone under the bus. And I then wrote, but my favorite line from Sondland's testimony is 2 + 2 = 4. And then someone put a comment, but just like Reagan, he never mentioned Donald Trump. He managed to somehow accuse on. And I said, no, you don't understand. When he's saying 2 + 2 = 4, 4 is Trump. 4 is Trump. He doesn't have to say the word Trump. Unbelievable this morning. I kept listening going, am I hearing this right? Am I hearing? And let me just say one more thing, Ken. You didn't like Sondland. I don't like Sondland. Sondland is so flip. He was almost laughing as he was giving his testimony. I mean, this is huge on so many levels. And his sort of like almost not caring sort of modus operandi. I was just like, oh, stop. Be a little more sober. But he wasn't. But what he was forthcoming about was shocking. And then the other really important line is, you know how the Democrats keep complaining that they can't get – they're asking for information, they're asking for notes, they're asking for memorandums, and they won't be given anything? Sondland kept saying the same thing. Yeah. I wish I had my notes, but they won't give them to me. I wish I had my memos, but they won't give it to me. So they won't give it to him. They won't give it to the Democrats. That tells you this is such an incredible cover-up.
Well, especially he says that he's not a note-taker himself, so – his memory is kind of vague. He's had all these meetings.
Right.
But if I had all these other documents and copies of emails and whatever, I could have my recollection refreshed.
Oh.
But he said the State Department wouldn't give it to him. It's just
incredible. It's so clamped down. They are so terrified. And then when he says he talks to Senator Johnson calls him and says, so, you know, is there a quid pro quo? And all you hear from Donald Trump is, absolutely not, absolutely not, absolutely not. It's just like the guy, you know, he robs the bank. Absolutely not. I didn't rob that bank. Oh, there's money back there? Where did that money come from? I mean, it's just, you just keep thinking, the more he protests, the more you know he's guilty.
Yeah.
The more he says no, you know the answer is yes. Donald Trump is such a freaking liar that every time he talks, you know, it's the exact opposite, and he's proven it with thousands of lies. Okay, I'll be done. It's been unbelievable.
Well, what you were saying, though, about how he's flip, and it's not just one of the lines I couldn't believe was when he was asked about telling Donald Trump that, oh, they love your ass. And he said, oh, ha, 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 that's the way Donald and the president and I always spoke, with four-letter words, or in this case, three.
Oh, yeah.
He's laughing like, oh, it's so, a childish approach. He's really not seriously taking his duties as ambassador, as representative of the United States.
They're both in the hotel business.
All in this.
Let me just say something. They're both in the hotel business. They're both – they have this – like their common ground is not policy. Their common ground is not governing. Their common ground, frankly, is money. Because he gave $1 million, and that they've been the same biz for a long time. Okay, so that is what they know. So they use the language that they know. They don't know the language of policy. They don't even care about policy, which is why they have this sort of interesting relationship, which has nothing to do with the fact that he's an ambassador. It has to do with the fact that they understand commas and checks.
Yeah,
I mean, let's be honest.
But the other thing he has in common with Trump is that they're both kind of have this frat boy mentality.
That's exactly – he was a frat boy.
You know,
he was a frat boy.
Let's sort of laugh it up. And somebody testified last week that Trump doesn't give a you-know-what about Ukraine.
Yeah.
All he cares about is
and
own,
you saw
you know,
that today with Sondland's testimony.
But Sondland, and it sounded – the way he was talking about his job, doing his job, it sounds like he didn't give a you-know-what about doing his job. It was all just sort of, oh, I'm swearing with my buddy, the president, calling him from the plane and blah, blah, blah.
I think there's a little bit more of a mugwump on that one. I think he was trying to say that he knew that, you know, that Ukraine really needed the money. He kind of – I mean, he was trying to look a little bit ambassadorish, if that's a
yes,
word.
Yes, he was trying.
He was trying, but he was – but he would undermine himself with the next sentence. I'm like, ugh.
Right.
All right, I'm calm. Anyway,
okay.
What's up with you?
And then we'll talk. My brief topic for today is I had the pleasure yesterday of picking up the airport and then bringing to Temple Beth Jacob, my synagogue, a woman who is a Muslim named Menaz Afridi. Mm-hmm. She teaches at Manhattan College, a mm-hmm. Catholic college mm-hmm. in New York City. She teaches at a Catholic college. She is a Muslim herself, and her field of study is Holocaust and genocide studies.
Why didn't you bring her to the radio so she could have helped me with my interview yesterday?
Well, I begged her to be on the show, and she didn't want to do it.
Did you tell her what we were doing? Think about it. The day that you were driving her, we were talking about Kristallnacht with one of the top Jewish historians in the world.
Yes.
Just to let her know.
And she knows him, but she didn't want to do it on your show.
That's fine.
She was traveling and everything. Had work to do, actually, mm-hmm. to prepare for her lectures the next day. But one of the beautiful things about just the gestalt of her being there was that here is – and she goes around the country, around the world. She is a Muslim woman talking about the Holocaust. She is a person who recognizes the suffering of other people, mm-hmm. acknowledges it, and talks about it. She talks about it with her Muslim community mm-hmm. to make sure that they understand where mm-hmm. the Jews have this fear of mm-hmm. the Holocaust, where that's coming from. She talks to the Jewish community to let them know that mm-hmm. Muslims mm-hmm. do know that this is a big deal and it did happen and it's outrageous and we will never let it happen again and that we will work together to do a better job for the world in the future. So just her being there and then to hear she speaks in a very calm kind of way.
Did she speak last night?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And there was a good turnout, not just Jews from the temple, but people from Concord community and at least one or two Muslims that we know.
Yeah.
But she's very calming. So it's a discussion about Islam and Judaism and the history that they've had for thousands of years.
They're both Semitic people.
In a way where you recognize the humanity of each other.
And the commonality of each other.
Yeah, the commonality. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it was really a wonderful experience, and I feel very lucky to
have been able to. Did they tape her conversation? Because I would love to be able to play it on the radio. Because we could do that. Even if she won't show, we can take her words and put her words on because that would be powerful.
Right, right. And she might actually be willing to do it over the phone at some point.
You don't know if anyone videotaped it or taped the conversation.
I'm pretty sure nobody videotaped it, but somebody may have recorded it. I do not know.
As you're describing this individual, you know what this reminds me of? Back when I was 17 years old, I founded the UN Club at Hicksville High School. And I went to my first model UN. And what shocked me was that a yeshiva had chosen the Palestinians as their country. They represented power. This is years and years ago in the 1970s. That was very cool. So I'm thinking about this woman, looking and studying the Holocaust, and I'm remembering that it was a yeshiva a Jewish high school. I was shocked. I was like so proud. I was so proud.
But you know what this world is like. So she has taken some flack from, among others, the Muslim community, some members of the Muslim community saying,
"And you do the right thing, you always get
that. Why don't you share the pain of our own people?" And not literally calling her a traitor, but it's that kind of outlook, just like some in this country called J Street traitors for advocating that the Palestinians are entitled to be treated like human beings too.
Right.
So it was great.
It's great. I'm honored that you went, and now that we have a connection to her, we'll work on her.
Oh yes.
All right. Before we grab our first guest, I have announced. I put it on the Attitudes Facebook page. I put it on Arnie Arneson's Facebook page, so you can go to the Facebook and see it. But I decided that every day between now and next week's Thanksgiving, I'm going to read the opening line, the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vidman, and I have them here, and I'm going to read them, and you're going to get them from me every single day as I open the show. The uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army, is that of the members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation. I'm humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I want to spend my life serving this nation. It gave my family, that gave my family refuge from authoritarian depression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer life. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history and story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. And offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I am grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and for my family's safety. Dad, says Vindman, I am sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. I'm having such a tough time reading this. And that is proof that you have made the right decision. The decision that you made 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, to come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine, Dad, for telling the truth. I am going to read those words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman every day between now and Thanksgiving. They are powerful. They are important. What was so shocking to me was when we read those lines yesterday, right after he had uttered them on the radio, I had Bill Curry on, and Bill Curry said, did you see the New York Times? I said, no. The military is so worried about the safety of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman that they are talking about moving him to a military base in order to protect his life and the life of his family. Please, God, make it be that he will be okay for speaking the truth. Please, God. All right. Joining us right now on the air is our first guest. I apologize, Rebecca. So forgive me. But this has been such an emotional last couple of days. I can't even tell you. So part one is about, we're going to be talking about nuclear weapons. We're going to be talking about nuclear deterrence. And I met Rebecca at a party. Don't you love it? You can't ever meet me at a party and think you get away with it. Rebecca Davis-Gibbons is a postdoctoral research fellow with the Belfer Center's Project on Managing the Atom and International Security Program. She previously served as a visiting assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, teaching courses on nuclear issues, international relations, and the international order. She earned her Ph.D. in international relations from Georgetown University. Her dissertation examined how the U.S. persuaded other states to join the nuclear nonproliferation regime. Yada, yada, yada. So I started by saying, Rebecca, assume a blank slate. You know, most of us don't focus on this. Most of us don't even know what's happening right now, even as we speak, with the INF Treaty. I want you to give us a little bit of a history, because one of my favorite lines that you wrote in the future of the nuclear order was the idea, and I want to just read the opening two sentences. Foreign policy pundits have bemoaned the unraveling of the post-World War II international order in recent years, describing threats to the multilateralism and liberalism enshrined in post-war institutions. An often overlooked component of that structure is the global nuclear order, which, like other parts of the post-war system, and this is my favorite line, was created for magnanimous and selfish aims. reducing the dangers of nuclear weapons for all and serving the interests of the world's most powerful states. And, of course, what I kept thinking, Rebecca, was I've got mine. You're not getting yours. That's kind of what I thought. So let's exactly. So let's walk through a little bit of the history, but also about the fact that you are very concerned because you see the wheels really falling off the bus and they're falling off in rapid order. And what really frightens me is even Donald Trump is actually almost threatened the use of nuclear weapons. I think the idea that they follow him around with that little briefcase gets him so excited about his potential power and the idea that he could actually threaten that. I know it is an oh gosh. So welcome to the program, Rebecca. Now, you only have about 10 minutes, I apologize. But please walk us through this to the best of your ability.
All right. Well, first, thank you for having me. I love talking about this topic. But I should also add that I'm an assistant professor in the University of Southern Maine. I'm from Maine and a proud Mainer, so I didn't want to go overlooked.
No.
I am very concerned about the nuclear nonproliferation regime, so I'll walk very briefly through some history and then tell you where I think we are today and what the concerns are. And so we know the nuclear age started in 1945, but I'm going to start in the 1960s. So we had the terrifying incident of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62, and then in 64, China exploded a nuclear device. And after that, in the mid-60s, the Soviet Union and the U.S. start negotiating the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And that treaty enshrines five countries as being allowed to have nuclear weapons. You know, per this treaty, per international law, they are allowed to have nuclear weapons. And that's the U.S., Soviet Union, and now Russia, China, Great Britain, and France. And those were the countries that had exploded a nuclear weapon in the summer, by the summer of 1967, when the treaty was being negotiated. And so the treaty says those states can have nuclear weapons, but any other state that joins is a non-nuclear weapon state. So they are promising not to develop nuclear weapons, and in exchange for that promise, they are supposed to have access to peaceful nuclear technology, so for making energy, for medical purposes, for agricultural purposes, and then very importantly, everyone who joins the treaty commits to pursue eventual disarmament. And it's not just nuclear disarmament, it's general and nuclear disarmament.
Okay.
And so I think some of the problems that we have with the treaty relate to this disarmament promise and this idea that the nuclear weapon states, those five states, are not living up to their part of that bargain.
Okay.
And so we see that today with what you mentioned, with we're losing the INF, right? That's been the only nuclear treaty that got rid of a whole class of nuclear weapons.
Right.
And now there's a real concern that the Trump administration is not going to extend the New START treaty. That was the treaty that was negotiated in the Obama administration, and it limits both the U.S. and Russia to 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. And the treaty has a provision for a five-year extension. And so that is what Russia has said it wants to talk about and it's willing to do, and the Trump administration is still discussing it. If we lose that treaty, then there's really no nuclear arms control.
Right.
And in the past, the U.S. government has used the existence of things like New START, or before that, the START treaty negotiated during the 80s, to say, look, this is how we're abiding by our treaty commitment to pursue eventual disarmament, is through arms control. And so the concern is that when the NPT parties meet next year, and it's the 50th anniversary of the treaty in the spring of 2020, they'll come together in New York in the spring and meet, and there'll be a sense that, you know, we didn't, your side is not living up to the bargain, and why should we be a part of this treaty anymore? And I don't think they're going to walk away en masse. I think that's unrealistic. But I think it does delegitimize and undermine the bargain. And I think in the long term, that will have a negative impact.
So, Rebecca, who actually has nuclear weapons today? My understanding is Pakistan has them. I mean, so give me the landscape today. And one of the things I remember studying a couple years ago was that one of the scientists from Pakistan is the one who shared the nuclear technology with North Korea. I mean, I want people to know that, you know, what we saw with the five nations is a very different landscape today.
Yes, you're right. So there are five states that are outside the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
Okay.
So, as you said, there's India and Pakistan, Israel.
Right.
North Korea withdrew. It's the only country that has done so, and it withdrew in 2003. And then South Sudan is the newest state in the international system, and they have not joined. I assume at some point, you know, they're distracted, but at some point they might join. But those other four states are all nuclear weapon states outside of the treaty. And so there are 9 nuclear weapon states, the 5 and then those 4 that I mentioned, and there's no real mechanism for those states to join the treaty. And you're right that someone who worked on the Pakistani program, A.Q. Khan.
A.Q. Khan, exactly.
A.Q. Khan is known for selling plans and technology. North Korea, also Iraq, Libya. A real concern for proliferation. And then now we have, you know, this summer, Turkey's leader Erdogan said, you know, I don't really like this bargain. How come these states are allowed to have nuclear weapons and I'm not? You know, so there's... And then Iran's foreign minister kind of floated the idea in the spring that, oh, maybe we'll leave the NPT. I don't think they will. I think that would cause them even more problems than they're having now. But just floating this idea, and then if they did that, you imagine the Saudis would try to get nuclear weapons. So,
exactly. The race is on.
Yeah, well, I think we're at a real inflection point where things could go in different directions, and I think... we want to go in the right direction, and so making sure that we keep arms control, and I'm not saying it's easy. I do think the easiest step right now is just extending New START. The follow-on, what comes next, will be quite difficult, right?
Yep.
Russia wants to include ballistic missile defenses. Our government has traditionally not wanted to include that in treaties. The Trump administration has talked about making this a trilateral treaty with China, but Russia and the United States still have significantly more nuclear weapons. You know, ours are measured in the thousands, so whether it's, it depends on if you count the ones that are awaiting dismantlement, but, you know, we have in 5,000 to 6,000, and, you know, by most accounts, China has maybe 300.
But aren't we committed to now spending millions and billions of dollars in order to upgrade our nuclear capacity?
Right.
I mean, so I feel like, you know, at one point we're talking about, you know, sort of draining the swamp, and now we're adding to it, or we're refining it, or we're making them better, if that's a term of art, which is really scary to me. You write something that I thought was really important, and you didn't really want to talk about this, but I want you to talk about this. You write, the nuclear weapons taboo is considered one of the strongest norms in international politics. But at the end of that abstract, you also write, the logic and evidence presented in this paper, the paper that you wrote, suggests that the norm of nuclear non-use is much more fragile than most analysts understand. So are you saying that, you know, more and more of the world leaders are not looking at nuclear weapons as something they choose not to use, but not only are they using it as a threat, but they're now even addressing or embracing the idea of its potential use? I mean, what do they think that we don't know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some concerning signs that we've seen that haven't obviously broken the taboo, but have weakened the sort of negative association about nuclear weapons. I mean, you mentioned the Trump tweet, the "my button is bigger and works better." I mean, that kind of just loose talk about nuclear weapons. There was a tweet that came out last year at New Year's where Strategic Command put a picture of a B-2, which is a nuclear-capable aircraft, and they were referring to the ball that drops in Times Square, and they said, you know, if we ever needed to, we can drop something so much bigger, so much more powerful, with this sense of the tweet. And
that's
I remember seeing that and just saying, how is that an okay
how juvenile
thing to allude to? And they did end up pulling it, which is good, but I think that the cue kind of for what's appropriate and how we talk about these weapons come from the top, and it's not surprising to me that happened in this administration. I think other leaders have been much more calibrated. Putin has talked a lot more about his nuclear weapons. There's YouTube videos where you can see of him commanding nuclear exercises. He said that he alerted his nuclear weapons in 2014 surrounding going into Crimea. And so I think, and there's this whole debate about whether the Russian doctrine, if they have this idea called escalate to de-escalate, the idea of using a relatively small nuclear weapon to try to end a conventional conflict that they're losing. The U.S. says they have this. They sometimes deny that they have this strategy. But I think the assumption that Russia has that strategy has driven our own strategy. And now with the 2008 Nuclear Posture Review, which is the document that says kind of why we have nuclear weapons and what they're for, the one that came out with the Trump administration said we need to have lower yield submarine-launched nuclear missiles in order to be able to deter the Russians from doing what they're doing. So I think I see that as lowering the threshold for nuclear use.
So as I'm listening to you, I go back to in 1997, I was a fellow at Harvard, and I remember suddenly learning about something called loose nukes. And what so scares me now is that, you know, at one point we were very aggressive about assisting Russia in making sure that we could, you know, deactivate or protect these loose nukes. I would think that now Russia wants to open the gates. I think in a lot of ways they almost want to loosen it as opposed to deal with that issue.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would assume and hope that they would not want to use them, but I do think undermining, I mean, this is in a lot of areas, right, kind of undermining global order and making things less stable, I think they see as being in their interest.
Yes.
We used to work much better with them in the past on promoting non-proliferation, and I don't see them as the same partners as they once were in this area.
Could I ask, we only have about a minute left, but could you speak briefly to the countries that are not in the treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Because it seems to me the country, well, Iran is obviously in the news with its potential, and Pakistan and India, every time they come to a hot place, we wonder whether there's going to be a nuclear war, and Israel has nuclear weapons. The countries that have them but aren't in the treaty, I guess the treaty really isn't relevant, and how do we address that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue, but I just want to make clear that Iran is in the NPT, right? So even without the Joint Comprehensive, without the Iran deal, they were still bound by the treaty, and they had safeguards and international inspectors coming in. Mm. So I just want to add that. But I think that's a real challenge, and that's one thing I try to get at with that piece on the future of nuclear orders. Like, this order is not sustainable for the next 50 years without figuring out a way how we're going to either incorporate those states into this regime. You know, Israel probably did have its weapons before that date, that cutoff date. It's just it didn't test, which I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Or it didn't test as far as we know. And so I just think this is an issue that's going to take massive leadership that we're not in a place for right now.
And what's so scary to me is that we're so distracted, Rebecca. I remember what I said? I said start with a blank slate, because we're all a blank slate. Because even you point out in that paper that you wrote, The Future of the Nuclear Order, that even as people are talking about the unraveling of the post-war international order, they're not talking about this. And this is the potential to do such incredibly destructive things. We're going to get you back. And we're going to give you a full half hour, and you're going to hold our hand, and you're going to walk us through everything we need to worry about. Because actually what I'm really worried about is that the world order will change. It won't be Russia. It won't be the United States. It won't be the EU, it'll be China and India. And are we recognizing where the new power is shifting to? And that's also a very difficult thing for the current powers to even acknowledge where the future power is going. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Her name, Rebecca Davis-Gibbons, a postdoctoral research fellow with the Project on Managing the Atom and International Security Program at the Balfour Center. And you also teach where?
At the University of Southern Maine in Portland, Maine.
I want to make sure I get that in. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Ciao.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. Hey, this is the only show that talks about nuclear weapons on the day that Sondland is testifying. Just want you to know that.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1896. That was the day anarchist and labor activist Rose Posada was born. Her name, Raquel Piasotti, was changed like so many others at Ellis Island. She had fled Tsarist Russia in 1913 as a teenager and soon found work in New York City's garment shops. She readily joined the ILGWU, becoming a national organizer by 1920. In the late 1920s, Rose went to Los Angeles in an attempt to organize Latina sweatshop workers. There, she helped women workers establish a bilingual labor journal and assisted them in winning a key strike for recognition and higher wages in 1933. She soon ascended to the position of union vice president and worked closely with the newly formed CIO. Rose traveled far and wide to organize garment workers. She led successful strikes throughout the United States and in Montreal and Puerto Rico. By 1936, she was on the picket lines with striking rubber workers in Akron, Ohio, and auto workers in Flint, Michigan. She increasingly found herself at odds with ILGWU head Dave Dubinsky and other top male union officials over persistent sexism, her radical politics, and her opposition to the no-strike pledge during World War II. Rose resented the fact that though women comprised the overwhelming majority of the union's membership, she continued to be the only woman union officer. Frustrated by the chauvinism she experienced, Rose resigned from her post as vice president and later from the ILGWU executive board in 1944. She continued as a sewing machine operator, remained active at the local level, and published two memoirs. Later in life, she aligned herself with the civil rights movement. Rose Posada died of cancer in 1965.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As renewable energy grows, solar jobs are on the rise, with opportunities ranging from installers to sales and management. Corrine Talo is with the nonprofit We Act for Environmental Justice.
There are a lot of opportunities in the solar industry, but what we're seeing, unfortunately, is that the diversity of the industry is not reflective of our society.
A recent report from the Solar Foundation shows that women make up only about a quarter of the solar workforce, and senior executives are overwhelmingly white. But the same report finds that a growing number of companies are working to increase the representation of women and people of color. Talo says, for example, solar firms can partner with historically black colleges and universities to offer internships. She says environmental justice organizations are also working to promote diversity. In New York, We Act provides solar job training and requires installers for its projects to hire some local trainees. She says as more people gain access to solar energy,
not only do we want to see people of color have the benefits of reduced bills and also reducing our carbon footprint, but we want them to also be able to benefit from the economic opportunities as well.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I love it. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Ken Barnes picks our music, and you will understand why he chose this. So which rapper did Trapped?
This is Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, you can tell. Yeah, even I.
Superstar of rappers.
Absolutely, absolutely. So why are we playing this kind of music? Why are we doing this? Because our next guest wrote one of the most – how do I say this – I'm betwixt and between. It horrifies me, and at the same time, I kind of understand it. So I'm looking at the Atlantic Monthly, and I see this article, and the article is entitled "The Repurposing of the American Jail." Jails and prisons are becoming substance abuse treatment facilities, even for those who haven't been accused of a crime. Jessica Pishko is a writer and lead attorney for the 2019 Rural Criminal Justice Summit for the Deason Criminal Justice Center at SMU Law School in Dallas, Texas. A lot to say, Jessica. Welcome to the program. This story touches me on a million levels, Jessica. I will explain why, but thank you for, on such short notice, willing to join us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So a couple of things. I have a friend who worked for me, and I've taken him to detox. I won't even tell you how many times. And I know he's an alcoholic, and I know and I love him, and I'm always afraid for him. But he's always having difficulty getting into a substance abuse treatment center. But the other thing that happens is if he doesn't go to substance abuse and he drinks and drinks and drinks, guess what happens? DWI. And on his fourth DWI, four, he finally got sent to jail. And when he called me from jail, and he'll probably be sentenced for at least a year, I was not unhappy. One, because he never gets the kind of treatment he needs because we can't find it outside. Number two, he's going to kill someone or kill himself. And number three, at least I know that in prison he'll get cleaned up and maybe he'll even get some kind of substance abuse treatment because it's the only place that actually provides any. But your article was terrifying to me because my friend is a criminal. It's called TWI four times. But now we're talking about the fact that this sheriff in upstate New York was saying, wow, I've got empty beds. We're providing this. You know, this is working. Maybe I should partner with nonprofits and organizations that provide substance abuse treatment or would like to provide it, but they don't have the opportunity. Guess what? I do. So walk us through this story because it is both interesting, it is about desperation, it is about a lack of access, it's about a growing substance abuse problem, and it's also about some emptying of some prison beds and how do we fill those beds, maybe with people who aren't criminals, but they need treatment.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, sadly, your experience is not uncommon.
No, of course not.
And so, yeah, I think that what, you know, to sort of give people like Sheriff Apple credit, what they're thinking is that why not help people before they get arrested for these DWIs, right? So they're thinking, we know we have a population of people who have trouble accessing the kind of care they need. We know, and, you know, sheriffs say and families say that they call, you know, they call the police or they call their sheriff and ask them to arrest their loved one or their friend because they want them safe.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
No, but start with the beginning of your story because the sheriff didn't come to the idea of providing treatment within his prison willingly. He got talked into it and then he became a convert because he saw it actually working, which is a good thing. It is a good thing. And then he also began to realize that maybe some of his prison beds were emptying out because these are local jails. You know, we're not talking about the federal penitentiary. And so he has a responsibility from a revenue stream, let alone anything else, to also do something. Plus, he's also providing the substance abuse, and it's not just people inside that have a problem. It's people outside that have a problem. It sounds so logical, but the ACLU wants to throw up because they think it's a problem. So walk us through this dilemma.
Right. I mean, I think Sheriff Apple is actually a really interesting person.
He's very interesting.
Yeah, because he has undergone – I mean, look, he did undergo a change of heart.
He did.
The truth is that a lot of law enforcement – you know, professionals are not fans of what they call medication-assisted treatment, which is basically the use of Suboxone or methadone mm-hmm. as a way to help people kind of work through their substance use disorder. And so he was a person who was being responsive to the community, right? Like he voluntarily wanted to help people in the jail. He wanted their conditions to be better. We know that jails, local jails are very dangerous. We know that when many people come in, if they have a substance use disorder and they sort of, you know, involuntarily detox, I kind of hate to use that term, but involuntarily go into withdrawal. It's terrible. It's very uncomfortable and people die. So his thought was, well, let's do this the right way, right? And so he did. He became a convert. And then, you know, what I think sort of happened to him. And so we could, you know, he is a well-intentioned person.
He is.
Again, I have a lot of respect for him.
I do, too.
But then you sort of see where he has a conflict, right? Because, you know, and this sort of goes back to the interesting role that sheriffs have in managing their local jails. They both have a fiscal, as you point out, a fiscal responsibility
right.
to maintain their local jail, as well as what I think many of them see as like a civic responsibility to help people. And so, you know, but at the heart of it, sheriffs are also law enforcement. And so, you know, sometimes when, I guess, you're a carpenter, everything looks like a hammer, right? So when you're law enforcement, everything looks like law enforcement. And so their natural tool is a jail. And so New York State has instituted a series of bail reforms, which means that his jail has less people waiting for trial.
Right.
Which is a positive step. But
that's
then
good.
He has an empty facility, and no
Bingo.
One's really, yeah, so no
Bingo,
one's really tackled how to repurpose it.
Yeah.
I mean, what I think is interesting is, like, it's a real problem. Like, no one is helping them repurpose their facility. So he's thinking, well, let me use it to help people, because again, I do think people go into that profession because they do want to help people. Yeah. So yes, you sort of end up with a situation where I am actually, as you are, quite sympathetic to what he's doing, yeah. but also concerned that, you know, this is a tool people will turn to out of desperation.
So let me read something from your piece. Your piece is incredibly well written. Sheriff Apple went on the road to meet with other sheriffs and advocates for better MAT programs within correctional facilities. Back home, he gave the Albany County Correctional Facility a new name, everyone. Ready? It is now the Albany County Corrections and Rehabilitative Services Center. Oh, it's not just a jail. And brought in nonprofits and non-law enforcement personnel to provide services. This is the part I love the pictures too, by the way. Sheriff Apple also made another more unusual change. This is the operative language. He converted 25 cells into rooms for people who were homeless, including those struggling with substance use disorder, whether or not they'd been accused of a crime. The move represents a growing and controversial trend in the United States as communities struggle with the issue, such as homelessness and substance use disorder, and have begun using detention facilities to house people who haven't been charged with a crime or sentenced to incarceration. What you don't know, which I think is really important, is I just posted this story on Facebook telling everyone that I was going to do it, but then I did a shout-out to one of our fabulous state representatives, Rennie Cushing. And Jessica, the reason I reached out to him is that we did not have a facility for the severely mentally ill. We did not have a place for them to go. So what they were doing was they were putting them in prison. All right. And so these mm-hmm. and that was their choice. That wasn't their choice. They were being sent to prison because we didn't have a mental facility that could deal with them. And Rennie was so outraged. They had been sued so many times that we needed to build a separate facility. This, in a lot of ways, is even more loosey-goosier because I'm just trying to figure out. So you're homeless and you got like a TV set and a jail and you got like a nice fluffy bed. And do you get to walk in and out at your will? Do you get checked in? What kind of outfits do you wear in there? I mean, I'm looking at all this going, how do you make this into both a jail and a facility for substance abuse and homeless? And how do they work in a seamless fashion? Because it makes me think it's more prison than not.
Right. I mean, I think that is the exact issue. I mean, you know, this program hasn't started the program yet. And so in all fairness, we don't know exactly what the parameters will be. Yeah, I mean, and again, in fairness to him, he also he says he decommissioned those cells, so he says it's not a jail. Now, at the photos, they do look like jail cells, right? So you're sort of facing the question of like
they got turquoise towels. I mean,
that's a lot nicer than most jails.
And the bedding is gorgeous. Let me tell you, I'm looking for the art on the walls, and then I'll be completely content. I'm sure I'm not being a jerk, but I mean, I'm reading the article, screaming at it. Go on.
Yeah, it looks like a jail. I mean, there's no way around the fact that it looks like a jail. And jails are not, you know, most people do not want to be in a jail, voluntarily or not. So. I mean, I think that's a real concern. And, you know, can it work? Can people come in and out? I mean, it's something people haven't tried. The other program I bring up in Massachusetts is perhaps, I would say, more disturbing to the extent that those are folks who are put in jail-like settings and they're not permitted to leave. Yeah. Wow. And so that's, you know, I appreciate that Sheriff Apple is attempting to do something. He is attempting not to do something like a civil commitment, which you might also do with like seriously mentally ill people, have something where if you want to leave, you can leave. I guess it's a question about how that will actually feel to people.
And I so feel for him. I want to be outraged, and I am a bit outraged. But at the same time, I'm frustrated because I know there aren't substance abuse treatment centers. I know there isn't universal health care. I know they're closing local hospitals. So here's the choice. You know, go to jail for your treatment or die in the street. You know, I mean, I feel like we can be so perfect. And I think that's the sense of the sheriff, is that he realized he wears two hats. Yes, he's got a revenue issue. Yes, he's got the police issue. Yes, he's in charge of this jail. But he is also an officer of the peace. You know? And what he's seeing is the peace is so unsettled because, as you point out, deaths from drug overdoses have been steadily increasing over the past two decades. In 2017, drug overdoses accounted for more than 70,000 deaths. Opioid-related deaths, in particular, account for nearly 48,000. So he is looking at lowering life expectancies. He is seeing the challenge of health care. He's seeing the lack of access. He sees what happens with his prisoners who, if they didn't have this treatment, would end up back in his prison because he talks about the recidivism rate. And what he's trying to do is, rather than having them go out and come back in, maybe I can figure out a way for them never to have to come back in formally. You know what I mean? And that is the dilemma. And I know the ACLU is concerned about this, but did you ask the ACLU, what is the alternative? And if we haven't provided the alternative, what do you do as you stare these numbers in the face?
I mean, I think that that's exactly right. And I share the same tension. I appreciate that they're trying to help. Same with the sheriff in Massachusetts.
Right.
I mean, look, he sees himself as like trying to help people. You know, I think when I talked to the ACLU, I mean, again, people did not really want to comment on a program that hadn't actually started yet, right? Because it's not quite fair. You know, it's not quite fair to say this doesn't work and he hasn't even tried. I think the concern is that, you know, and I think what they would say, and what I, you know, would also agree with is that best practice is to have these resources in the community, right? We want people to sit, be integrated with the community, to go to work, to be with their families, to take their kids to school, you know, and that sort of, I think, speaks to the overall way in which I think society really sees people who have substance use disorder. And one of the things I found working on the story and thinking about the space was the extent to which even, you know, I myself, in approaching the piece, had ideas about that people with substance use disorder weren't, you know, as if they were only their use disorder and they weren't anything else. They weren't parents or workers or all these
things.
Exactly.
And,
yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And the truth is they're people, right? And they have individual needs that, you know, I think it's very hard because really what you want to give people, like I think what people would want for their child is the best individual treatment plan you could have, right?
Right.
You want them to do well in life, whatever that looks like for them. And the best people I know in this space, that's what they do. But that is so hard and it's so expensive. I mean, it would be, like I said, I think of how when you have your child and you think, okay, what is the best thing? You could spend your life, all your time trying to figure that out. But these are people who don't have anyone to do that for them.
Well,
and as you point out, we don't have, you know, we don't have Medicaid for all.
We don't
have these resources.
Well, and see, that is my absolute dilemma. So in my state of New Hampshire, we had a facility in Concord, and we decided that we wanted to dismantle this facility. We wanted to allow people to get the kind of, you know, rehabilitative services and mental services that they could get within the community. And the idea was we were going to close this institution and that the money was going to follow these people into the community and there would be community service. Well, guess what? We did close it. Guess what didn't happen? The money dried up. Most of the people don't get the kind of services they need. So we've already proven we can't really follow through. And I think that's why the story of this sheriff in upstate New York is so interesting, and whether he gets to goal or not, whatever goal is. And for him, I understand that goals has, you know, there are many reasons for him doing this. But tell me a little bit about this Hampden County, Massachusetts, Sheriff Nick Cochi. What's this story? You said that you weren't been able to write something up, but you did announce that he created a wing of the county jail, which would be served for Section 35 detainees. And he called these lockups treatment centers. So what is a Section 35 detainee versus someone who's in jail?
So a Section 35 detainee is, I think, what a lot of us might sort of colloquial call something like civil commitment.
Okay.
Which, right?
Civil commitment.
Like, we civilly commit people who someone decides is a danger to themselves or others, right? So it's sort of when you can involuntarily commit someone. The interesting thing about Section 35 in Massachusetts is that it's only for drug treatment. It's only for those kinds of people. So if someone says, okay, I think that you are a danger, it can be anyone. Yeah. It can be like a family member. It could be a doctor, which I think introduces some problems. It could be judges or like officers. So, right, it's not voluntary on the part of the individual. Not even like their mom.
Not even their mom.
Is it time limited? Like ordinary civil commitment is 3 days. You can hold somebody.
It's time limited, but the limited time is about 3 months. So it's a pretty long time. Yeah. I mean, it's not, a day. It's a long time.
Well, but let me just say something. And when you are addicted, a long time, 48 days is not a long time. It may be, in fact, what you need, because you write in your article, people who enter the program stay an average of 48 days, longer than patients that can stay in private facilities. And unlike in other treatment programs, those in this program receive assistance reintegrating into society, resolving any open arrest warrants or criminal charges. I mean, in a lot of ways, I feel like it's a gestalt. They're giving them the time that they wouldn't get in a private facility. They also understand reintegration is usually the biggest challenge to some extent. And if it isn't done effectively, they're back in anyway. And it's not even, I mean, they may be back in on, another sort of criminal charge. So, and I have this sense that our prisons, kind of like our educational institutions, are becoming a dumping ground for what we're not able to solve as a society.
I think that's absolutely true. I think it's very sad but true. And the issue with Section 35, I think, is that it feels punitive, right? And mm-hmm. I think that the concern that people have is that people with substance use disorders ought not to be punished for a medical condition. Right. We wouldn't, if someone, let's say you had a loved one who had cancer, and they said, well, I don't want to get treatment for my cancer. We wouldn't not lock that person up and say, you must get treatment for your cancer.
Exactly.
Or we will lock you up till you do so. And we don't, right, because we think that those people have autonomy over their choice of treatment and what they want to do and when they want to do it. You could certainly talk them into it. That's not, right, that's not a problem, and people might. But you wouldn't approach it that way. And so I think the concern is something like, why do we approach substance use disorder like not like cancer or even something like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's.
But I'm going to challenge you on that. I'm going to challenge you. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I'm being a devil's advocate because I'm looking at what Leo Beltsky, a professor of law and health sciences at Northeastern School of Law, said, and he was really worried that the civil commitment is now just becoming a rebranding of incarceration. So he says it sounds nice, but the result is incarceration. So the difference, however, I think, with substance abuse, and I'm going to use this with my friend, who I'm applauding the fact that he's in jail. He's not going to kill himself. He's not going to kill someone else. And that is, when I got cancer, it's not contagious. When I have cancer, when I'm driving, I mean, there may be a chance that I could hurt someone, but the likelihood is I'm not. But if you have a substance abuse addiction problem, it creates a myriad of problems that other health issues do not. And that is because you have to feed the abuse, because that's what it is, because you're constantly drinking, you're constantly looking for drugs, that it can somehow make you, incapable of functioning. And when you get behind a wheel, you can actually be dangerous, because a car is a dangerous weapon. And so there is a difference. And I think for us not to acknowledge the difference is to be somewhat dishonest with the reality. But the real reality here is we need substance abuse programs. They need to be affordable. They need to be accessible. They need to include reintegration, and they should not be the responsibility of the criminal justice system. And once you make it part of that responsibility, you've changed the conversation.
I think so. I guess I don't want to sort of suggest everything is the same, but I do think that people with substance use disorder get sort of villainized in a way that other sort of issues do not, because I think there's sort of a, residual dislike of, people using substances, people using illegal substances. It's sort of like people can't just get their act together. Why can't they get over it? And I think what you have to also consider is that they're still sort of whole people. One of the advocates I also spoke to points out the fact that jails are pretty unhealthy, so you are also sort of sacrificing all the rest of their life
exactly
to solve this thing, which, again, I understand.
No.
Look, Yeah, I get it. And people do it because they are desperate.
And here's the sad thing about all this is that now that we've seen the opioid crisis and it affects every walk of life, that the two states that have some of the worst problems are the wealthiest state, one of the wealthiest, New Hampshire, and one of the poorest, West Virginia. So guess what? It's wealth blind, too. So now that it's come into our communities, now it's come into middle-class families, now it's come into wealthy New Hampshire and poor West Virginia, I think people are beginning to understand it is a problem. It is a health problem. It is a public health problem. So I think that, you know, the way we look at people with substance abuse is evolving only because it is becoming so prolific, which is so scary.
Can I just add, in some senses, it seems almost like this potential program is part of the continuum, just an extension of what we have applauded in the criminal justice system, which is a diversion program for people who are substance abusers or something like that. And they only for the first arrest, but at that point they can get diverted. And instead of going to jail, they can voluntarily commit themselves to a rehab program.
Yeah, it's a very
This is sort of like that, only one step before the first arrest. Reaching out into the community to prevent it. And so and the other thing I thought of about the use of the half-full jails is, what about merging two jails in the area which are each half-full and having one be just like using an old school for apartments? It's exactly. Have it be a rehab center. It used to be a jail, but now it really is a rehab center.
But it's very territorial. Anyway, it's an amazing piece. Thank you so much for writing
thank
it because it's really important for us to recognize this. And I want to end with your last line. Sheriff Apple said, "No one else is doing anything to help these people. Maybe you don't like the way we're doing it, but I can go to sleep at night." And, you know, there's a piece of me that sort of understands exactly what he's saying. I'm not a happy camper. I'm furious about this as a solution. But you know what? Until we have a solution, then sheriffs like our Sheriff Apple is going to resort to doing something like this because from his perspective, it's a win-win. The repurposing of the American jail. Jessica Pischko wrote this. It's in this week's The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
All right. And we end with Monsieur.
Well, we're ending with a song that's appropriate to the nuclear discussion, No Nuclear War by Peter Tosh.
I love Peter Tosh. Here we go.